Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am, of course, joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
Okay, Nicholas, how are you?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. And we are also joined by Mr. Tieko Tsotse, who is in Limpopo. And Tieko, I believe it is rather warm up there at the moment.
Yeah, it's quite warm yet. Yeah, there's a bit of wind at the same time. Good afternoon, Nick. Good afternoon, Terence, and to the viewers as well.
Very good to have you on. Anyway, so before we start, I just want to give a word from our sponsor today, and that is, of course, Bitvice. So Bitvice says that Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And thanks to them very much for sponsoring our show. All right, let us get into today's stories. If I can just find the correct window on my computer, there we go. Terence, let's start off with the reason why you couldn't be on the show yesterday. We had actually a shortage of manpower, as I'm sure regular listeners will know. But I couldn't ask Terence to be on because he was doing something much more important than appearing on this humble podcast, and that was speaking before the highest decision-making body in the country, the halls of Parliament, at least virtually, I believe. Terence, tell us about why you were there. You were speaking in support of a private member's bill before the Parliamentary Committee on Public Service and Administration. What was the bill proposing? What did you say? Please tell us all about it.
Well, modestly, Parliament only became the highest decision-making body after the Guptas decamped Rosebank or Parktown or wherever they were. It's quite a compound, actually. I've been past it a few times. I was speaking to the Standing Committee on Public Service Administration. It was a private member's bill introduced by Leon Schreiber of the DA, which effectively aimed to try and outlaw political preferment, favoritism, and interference in appointments, and in a more technical sense, to strengthen the independence and autonomy of the Public Service Commission. The Public Service Commission was one of those bodies that one of the great might have beens of the constitutional dispensation. I think there was a lot of thinking around this in the mid 1990s that this would kind of be the body that would effectively run the civil service. It would kind of become almost a Chapter 9 institution, but it ended up being largely a guidance and advisory body, and as the committee itself has noted on a few occasions with some concern, as many as 80% of its recommendations actually get ignored. So yes, it does have a role, and another provision of this law would have required it to mandate merit-based criteria for appointment, promotion, etc. Now, I'm sure that perceptive readers will be able to see in this the whole cadre deployment fingerprint. I was very, very careful. I didn't use the term cadre deployment because I thought actually this was a very valuable piece of legislation, both for its intention and for the institutional reforms that it was proposing. So I spoke about the impact of politics on politicization on our public institutions. And I could point to many examples of official documents now that recognize this as a problem. I mean, National Planning Commission said that the rejection of meritocracy has basically killed the hope of South Africa's state being capable, let alone developmental. So I said, you know, nothing here is actually contentious. And I spoke in support of the principle that that undue political interference needs to be combated, and I think there has to be, you know, serious sanctions for doing so. And I thought that the suggestion about bolstering the role of the Public Service Commission was also a good one. My sense of it is that it's not going to solve every problem. It's not a silver bullet, and we probably want to see more happening in due course. But you know, to the extent that this moved the needle, I thought that was very valuable. Interestingly, one of the other presenters, a guy from the PARIA, the Public Affairs Research Institute, that's affiliated with WITS and UCT, said that he didn't support the bill because it wasn't going far enough. It would still have left some room for interference. So, you know, I seem to be in favor of a watered down version. Anyway, it needed to be kind of adopted by the committee before it could start its torturous process through the halls of power. But it became apparent that the ANC caucus in particular was not really having any of this. It didn't actually come to a vote, but the chairman in the end said, no, well, he gets the sense that there's more opposed than in favor. And he took it upon himself in the last couple of minutes to say, well, I just want to make it clear that there's nothing wrong with cadre deployment. Cadre deployment's great. Cadre deployment is, you know, sometimes you get the odd bad decision, but generally speaking, cadre deployment's where it's at, you know. And I think, you know, as our president and as our COGTA minister said, you know, the new cadre deployment that's coming is going to be the cadre deployment that makes cadre deployment great again. So, one just has to shake one's head, doesn't one?
Indeed. Tiago, let me play devil's advocate for a second here. And, you know, there's always been this kind of argument, I think, from ANC defenders, and they say, you know, cadre deployment, you're all just being, like, overly sensitive about this. Every political party in the world makes sure that people who align with their view of how government should run gets people appointed into senior positions in the civil service. There isn't really such a thing as a completely, you know, apolitical civil service. At the end of the day, we're just more upfront about the fact that we do this. And we, you know, we have, Cyril might say something along the lines of, you know, we've definitely put some bad people into senior positions in the past, but there's no real problem with this because we've recognized this mistake. And from now on, we're going to only put in ANC cadres who are competent, right? This is a line I've also heard from some ANC members that the real problem with cadre deployment is not the cadre deployment per se. It is the putting of incompetent people in. And it doesn't matter so long as if they're going through an ANC internal process. What do you make of that argument, Tiago?
Well, it's almost that it's a nonsensical argument because really that's what it is. But what I think is that the point that they are missing is that in deploying your cadres to positions and not allowing the rest of the society to have access to opportunities, that's a crisis. When you have a position, it should be open for anyone who qualifies for it to contest for it, go through all the processes that are meant to be gone through, interviews, applying, writing competency tests and stuff of that nature. When you do that, when you do away with that and simply put an ANC person, it becomes an unfair process, right? It's no longer fair. People are no longer hired on the basis of merit. They did not get to compete for that position. It's an unfair position. I think one would would understand their position more if they, as the ANC, were not actually taking people by their hands and putting them into positions within departments, within SOEs, within municipalities. If instead what they were doing is that they were meeting as the ANC, and they, as an ANC, saying that we think such and such a person should run for such a position and we're going to help them prepare for it, rather than this thing of sitting together panels. When you get to departments, you check the panels. It's such two people. It's called such two people, ANC people, because it's an agreement that was arrived at in advance. I remember one particular incident, and I'm not even sure if I should be speaking about this, but I'll speak about it. When I was still young, my father coming back from work, very upset, because they were in interviews, and the MEC of his department at the time apparently sent a note to them in the interview panel saying that these are the people who should be hired. And he's one of those people who rejected the whole thing and said that we need to have a fair process altogether. And since then, really, his life at work became quite difficult and stuff of that nature. But that can't be fair, that we sit as a caucus somewhere as an ANC people and decide that we are going to open... Well, the department is going to, for example, the department is going to open these positions. Well, as a department thing, department will open these positions. Then we are going together and decide by our own. I mean, what's the whole point of even having these interviews if you already know who's coming? They recognize themselves that they are cheating, really. I don't know what else to say apart from that, but I think they very well recognize. Otherwise, they wouldn't be opening, departments wouldn't be opening advertisements and stuff of that nature. If it's as easy as that and there's nothing wrong with it, they would simply go to an ANC branch meeting, come back with someone and appoint that person without opening the processes. But because they know that they are cheating.
Think of all the time we'd save.
Yeah. We'd have saved a whole lot of time if we did things that way, you know.
Although I suspect that would be a step too far. So, okay, Terence, final thoughts from you. But you know, the one point I really want to make on this is that, you know, candidate appointment really is completely incompatible, in my view, with meritocracy, because candidate appointment essentially says that loyalty to the party is the most important criteria for selection, right? Because that's the one thing that you can. If you're not loyal to the party, you don't even get considered. And the moment that that enters into the equation, you cannot create a meritorious environment, because you're always going to pick the more loyal person over who's less competent over the less loyal person who's more competent. Terence, what are your final thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I think that before you even get into the question of competence, it's just, I think it's frankly unconstitutional and illegal. Now, the Zondo Commission said that, but our viewers will be happy to know that their tax money is going to fight this. This seems to be like the first major response to come out of the presidential office to say that the Zondo Commission is all just a bunch of suggestions. You know, it's a bit like that line in Pirates of the Caribbean where everyone's going parlay and the code and whatever, and he says, oh, well, that's, you got to be a pirate for that to apply, and the code is more like guidelines. Anyway, I think maybe this is the Jeffrey Rush, Johnny Depp school of a school of jurisprudence. So I just don't think you even get that far. But, you know, to the extent that all parties deploy, well, you know, you can put whomever you want in as your MP. That's your process. That is a political process. To maintain a professional civil service, though, which is really what we need, and a professional civil service can actually do a great deal to keep a country stable while politicians play musical chairs.
I think Belgium's the good example of that. They were without a stable government for 9 months or something, but because they've got a professional civil service, it didn't really get.
India also, although with major problems, very similar. China, Taiwan, South Korea, all those countries, you know, you have a very long tradition meritocratic civil service. So even if these wonderfully competent people can be found, and I don't think South Africa is at this point, you know, has a surfeit of talent. You know, it's just illegal. I mean, you know, it's like saying I robbed pensioners, you know, VBS in order to, you know, like support someone's lifestyle. You know, and that person has a right to a good lifestyle. I mean, no, it's ridiculous. You know, the ANC will also tell you, no, well, you know, it's not just about loyalists, it's about getting the right people. Someone like Mr. Derrida, for instance. Now, I don't know whether this is true or not, but what I'm saying is it's not a question of whether he was a good choice or a bad choice. You can argue the toss there. The question is they had no right to, you know, to make that discussion. There is nothing that gives them permission to clear his appointment. Forget it. No, you can't do that. It's wrong. Like I say, it's like stealing a pensioner's money, you know, because I felt I needed a Jaguar more than, you know, she needed to Pilchards. No, you can't do it. No matter how much you want that Jaguar.
No, exactly. All right, let's move on to our next topic. And this is an interesting little political development, a wrinkle for the anti-ANC coalition. So, of course, we've been watching coalitions very closely around the country because of the potential that a coalition could take power in 2024, unseating the ANC and EFF, depending on how the election results turn out. Well, there's been a big setback for the coalition in Johannesburg, where the multi-party coalition, which consists of the DA, Action SA, ACDP, COPE, Patriotic Alliance, and Freedom Front Plus, with, I think, some support from the IFP, lost the speakership of council. So we talked actually, I think a week or two ago, about Speaker Vasco da Gama, who was involved in an altercation with some EFF councillors in the Joburg City Council. He's the Speaker of the Joburg Council. And in what seems to have come as a bit of a shock to the anti-ANC coalition in Johannesburg, he lost the speakership by, I think it was 136 councillors voting for the motion of no confidence in him, which was originally brought by the African Independent Congress, the AIC, and 132 sort of supporting the speaker. He was accused of unlawfully appointing an acting council secretary and concealing the matter. And the thing that's really striking about this is that the DA and their other coalition partners seem to be pretty confident going into this that they were going to easily crush the motion of no confidence. However, according to some people who spoke to News 24, who did some reporting on this, the councillors from COPE, the ACDP, and the IFP all voted in favor of the motion of no confidence. So that in case of COPE and ACDP is particularly concerning because I believe that they have been signatories to the agreement with the bigger parties to be part of the coalition. In response to this, the mayor of Joburg, Paul Palatse, who's a DA councillor, said, "We note with utter shame that certain coalition members elected to vote in favor of the motion. We are also aware that there are allegations of bribery ahead of the motion, which will be detailed in an affidavit. As the multi-party government, we will introspect on what needs to be done to regroup, as Joburg cannot afford to be handed back to a cabal who placed self-interest ahead of the needs of Joburg's 6 million residents. We are nonetheless confident that we will restore order. This is but a speed bump on a long road. The repair and rebuild of South Africa's economic hub has just begun. Therefore, our work is far from over. We intend on completing this term of office," she said. Tieko, so obviously there's an accusation here that the COPE and ACDP councillors were bribed to vote for the ANC. I you know, who knows if that's true or not, but it's just kind of difficult really to see, like in COPE, I don't know how they're going to fix this problem because what is the, who is the DA and Action SA going to phone to try and get COPE back on board? Because it's not clear who the leader of COPE is at the moment. Everyone's suspending each other. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think all of this does not make sense. Of course, it's not the first time that we see anything of this nature happen. We have seen after coalitions formed in 2016, stuff of this nature happening. But my whole thoughts around this is that, and I'll speak directly to COPE and the ACDP. I personally, as I sit here listening to what happened, I don't think they are committed to the coalition government. You know, if you are committed to a government that you have come together to form together, and there are issues within that that government, surely you return to your partners and have a discussion around the issues, find a resolution to the issue. If indeed allegations directed towards Vasco da Gama that he appointed a secretary general in the council without following procedures, and it's indeed a problem that they had with the issue, right? It's an issue they had a problem with. Surely the first thing would have been to meet with the partners, have a discussion, decide on whether or not it's true, find the facts and all of that. And if the facts are there and he has indeed done what they say he has done, then you remove him, right? You don't immediately move towards the other side of the government and start negotiating with the people on the other side of the coalition government, because literally this is a government, it's a partnership that you are part and parcel of. It's like being part of a company. You have issues within a company, you should be discussing them and fixing that. Instead, you go to your competitors and say that, no, there are issues internally. They hired a driver that I don't like inside there. We did not have a discussion around it and stuff of that nature, and immediately start working with the competitor. It doesn't make logical sense. But more than anything, I think to me, it highlights that perhaps there was never a commitment. There were never really, really commitment to the agreements that were arrived at amongst the political parties they entered into a partnership with post 2021 elections. Yeah.
Terence, what do you make of all this? I think that this is pretty expected. In fact, I'm surprised it took so long. There was also a motion of no confidence called on the mayor, Paul Palazzo, but apparently there was some technical reason why that was disallowed. So who knows? Perhaps that also would have succeeded if it had still been on the order paper. So firstly, just your thoughts on how this is going in Joburg specifically. But then I think this really does show what governance in the post-2024 world might look like, where people lose their jobs a lot more often than we're used to as South Africans.
Yeah, look, I think that one would that to give a crisp and accurate assessment would require more insight than I have. One doesn't know exactly the texture of discussions or whatever, but I think that I just have to channel Jordan Peterson when he was talking about climate change, and he said, "Yeah, these are difficult matters, man." And I think that's the point. Animus towards the ANC, however richly deserved or otherwise it may be, is not an entirely satisfactory base. I mean, I think most of those parties would consider coalesce around the idea that anything is better than the ANC. And maybe that takes you 60% of the way. But then, you know, that other 40% is, you know, am I being given my due respect? Am I getting what I could? I like that position. I want it. I think that that particularly for some of the newer parties, there's this expectation that, you know, they provided a crucial bit of voting muscle, and therefore they must get a bonzella. And whereas the DA, I think, sometimes takes a very high-handed approach and says, well, you know, we've got experience at this. We're the biggest party. It's our patriotic duty to keep the ANC out, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure you could make arguments. You could make arguments either way, but that doesn't make cooperation any easier. And also bear in mind that I think the ANC still has the single largest bloc, which gives it enormous influence. You know, for every win that the coalition has, it's got to marshal a particular range of forces. For every win the ANC has, it's got to marshal a smaller group. So in a way, you know, although I think its brand is kind of irretrievably tarnished, it can still get wins issue by issue. Particularly by playing on the sort of sense of dissatisfaction, and this is politics. Egos are a big thing.
I think that's very worth pointing out, because of course, I don't think there's a person alive who doesn't think the ANC is going to be the biggest party in government in our parliament in 2024, even if they do very badly. You know, let's say the ANC got an absolutely terrible election result. But I don't know. Let's go to the outer bounds of possibility. Let's say 36%, right? Absolutely devastating. That will still almost certainly be 7, 10 points, 12 points ahead of the next biggest party.
Mm.
And so they're definitely going to be in a position to continue to play this sort of game where they just, you know, there's less cats to herd. So I think this kind of maybe leads into our next point sort of tangentially. But Tiego, just final thoughts from you on this. Interesting to me, the IFP still seems to be having this kind of identity crisis. I heard a story a while ago that apparently the IFP is fairly split with different factions, some supporting the anti-ANC coalition, some wanting to get closer to the ANC. And that divide runs right up into their parliamentary caucus, where apparently the rumors are that there are some of the IFP MPs want to work much more closely with the ANC, while people on the ground in KZN want to work against the ANC. Tiego, what do you make of all this?
Well, no, I think Terence is absolutely correct when he says that this is a very difficult topic to unpack. I think it's difficult even at that level. It could be anything really at that very level. But I think the what is possibly the fundamental dividing thing there is a question of interest. Question of interest. One person wants this, as Terence has mentioned. One person wants this. Some know that they can get this if they get into an alliance with the ANC. Some know that they can get this when they get into an alliance with the DA. Perhaps some are there really, really for the people. Some are there for the people half for themselves and stuff of that nature. I think it's a main thing that's dividing political parties. And that's a main thing that brings about the factions within parties. Of course, there's a question of ideology, but really mainly it's a lot of the times not around ideology or policy positions or anything else outside interests.
I think one of the amusing things might be that either another DA speaker or Vasco might get elected back in as speaker when the next election for speaker is held, because it's not clear whether this ANC majority is going to hold for too much longer. But anyway, okay, let's go on to our last story here, and this is a little bit of a brouhaha, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, that happened at KZN, when the DA said that it was concerned that the Department of Education in KZN was pressuring students into wearing traditional attire to celebrate and honor the new Zulu king. So the DA said that it's very happy to celebrate the king, but it just doesn't believe that anyone should be forced to do it. This is something that students should make up for themselves. The MEC for Education and the Education Department in KZN from the ANC said, look, you know, this is, no one's being forced. These people must just stop whining. Terence, you had some thoughts on this.
Yeah, look, I think there's two very interesting issues here. First of all, South Africa is not a monarchy. It's a constitutional republic. But a constitution does recognize traditional leadership. But one is, kind of, let's say, one pays deference to that based on one's own cultural orientation. So, in other words, if you your feelings towards the Zulu king are likely to be in some way, you know, attached to a certain Zulu ethnicity, or, you know, maybe a feeling of kinship. Not everyone is going to feel that, and I think this is an interesting challenge, and I use that word carefully. It's an interesting challenge for a multicultural society. How does the state interact with those cultural structures? It's the same thing, you know. We don't have the sort of American style wall between religion and politics. You know, religion has a place in the public square, but we don't have an official religion. So, you know, we sort of split the difference on that. The other thing I found interesting is this question of wearing traditional attire. He didn't specify what that should be. Now, you know, if if this is, you know, about celebrating our glorious diversity, I mean, you know, can someone come wearing a Basutu blanket or, you know, wearing the Coal Scuttle Voortrekker copy or interesting Scottish thing. Scottish Kilt. Yeah. I mean, tradition takes many forms. Your sari or your kurta or whatever, you know, this is KwaZulu-Natal. Quite a lot of that there. I think this also sort of raises another thing. You know, when we talk about heritage in a multicultural society, or your traditions. Do traditions of one culture honor a figure in another? I don't have any easy answers to this. And, you know, I suspect that the MEC was, you know, being a bit of a politician and, you know, let's carry some favor with a person of cultural significance to most of this culture's population. But it's an issue that I think requires a lot of thinking through.
No, very much so. Tiago, we don't have a lot of time, but in 30 seconds or so, your thoughts on this.
Well, the first thought would be to say that I don't understand why we have kings in a democratic South Africa. But I guess that's a conversation for another day. One as well wonders how they came to the conclusion that someone was a king, someone was not a king, who's an original king, who's not an original king, because really no one was born in this earth as a king. So it would be interesting to find out how they determine that. But more than anything, I think that it's nonsensical to want to force people to wear traditional attires to celebrate one culture and stuff of that nature. I think allow people, man, to just be themselves and wear whatever they want to wear. If anyone wants to celebrate because there is a new Zulu king in the room, great, let them celebrate. But if I don't feel like celebrating, don't invite me to the party of celebrating something that I'm not part of and has nothing to do with me, really. Those are my closing remarks, Joe.
All right. Thank you very much. And that is all the time we have for today and for this week. We will, of course, be back next week with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.